crash course in Pesach. Because next week what I'm going to do is we're going to hit the Seder. And I'm going to give you some insights to elevate your Seder. The fellows here are going to get some Seder material also tonight from Rabbi Pinney, and next week you'll get it from me at the 8 o'clock class. What I want to do tonight is really understand why we take Pesach so seriously, and how do we take it seriously? What are the mitzvot? What do we do? So take a look on this white page real quickly. How many mitzvot are there in the Torah, in Judaism? There are 613 commandments in Judaism. And guess how many pertain to Passover of those 613?
600.
8. 888. There you go. Sorry.
That's it.
Thank you.
That's it. What's that?
How many? 8.
I don't know. You know, you would think biblical. 8 biblical commandments. There are many more multiples of that when it comes to rabbinic, which we'll see in a little while. So the Rambam, take a look in his introduction, Maimonides and the Laws of Passover, enumerates 8 mitzvot which apply today. By the way, there are more. Right, because what's one thing our ancestors used to do to celebrate Passover we don't do anymore?
Korbans.
They had the Korban Pesach, they had Korban Chagigah, two different offerings. Each of those offerings had all sorts of rules and laws, you know, related to them. There's another mitzvah pertaining to all of the three festivals, which is called Aliyah L'Regel, which is to make Aliyah means to go to Israel at least for those three festivals, Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. There's no, you know, we don't have that today because that was really to go to the temple, although lots of Jews go to Israel for Passover, and there is a wonderful thing about going to Israel for the holiday. These are the 8 mitzvot left for us to observe. 3 positive, A, to dispose of your seor, which is one of the biblical terms for chametz, we're going to talk about that soon, of your leaven on the 14th day of the month of Nisan, specifically to get rid of chametz on the 14th day. Does anybody know when the 14th day of Nisan is? Next week, when does Passover start?
Friday night.
Friday night, therefore, is the 15th of Passover of Nisan, because that's when the Torah says to observe the holiday. On the 14th, we're told to dispose of the leaven the day before. There's also a mitzvah to eat matzah, specifically on the night of Passover. That's next Friday night. Let me just finish this and I'll answer your question. And then, of course, to relate the story of Pesach, which we're going to talk about next week when we talk about the Seder. That's how we discharge that commandment, by relating the story of the Exodus through the Haggadah and the Seder. What are the negatives? Not to eat chametz after noon on the 14th, which is next Thursday. So we don't just stop eating chametz when Passover starts. We back it up a little. And we stop eating chametz, you'll see in the packet I'm going to get to it, I think it's something like 10 or 11 in the morning. We're talking about on Friday now. I'm sorry, we're talking about on Friday. We don't eat, I'll get to it soon. And we're not supposed to eat mixtures of chametz, even if there's only a little piece of chametz in something, it makes the whole thing chametz. And we're not supposed to see it or find it, which means we can't legally own it. Which I'm going to get to a little about this whole idea of selling your chametz. I want to try to make this doable. Passover can seem very overwhelming. It's probably the most rich-filled mitzvah holiday. Not probably, it is. It's just so much, and I don't want to overwhelm everyone, but I want to give you a way of having a kosher and happy Passover by giving you first an idea. And then some questions about the details. 2 questions, and then I'll share the idea.
It's kind of a detailed question, but if, let's say, Thursday, you get rid of all your leavened bread,
right?
But you don't start eating matzah till Friday, is there this weird limbo period?
Correct. Where you're in a limbo period. There's a period of time when you're not eating the chametz and you're not eating the matzah. Hmm. You're supposed to, why? The day before, some people don't eat it the whole month before. Some people don't eat matzah all year round. I'm not such a Jew. I love matzah all year round. I think we should eat it every day. It's the best thing in the world. It's like crackers. How could it be bad? A little salt. It's perfect. But some people won't have it at all. Why? Why?
Is Manischewitz sponsoring tonight? That was quite good.
Why can't we... Help me out. Why shouldn't we eat matzah the day before? Because you want to eat it. Same reason you're not supposed to have a big lunch on Fridays. Now, you can have lunch on Friday, especially now in Shabbat. You spoil the special. You want to eat it bete avon. You ever been to a kosher restaurant? Yeah, that's rabbinic.
Yeah.
Actually, Yeah, it's rabbinic. Not to eat, so that the night of Passover, it's... You ever been to like a kosher restaurant and the waiter or waitress will say, B'te'avon? Maza B'te'avon? It means party appetite, you know, enjoy. So you want to eat something with a good appetite, which means you don't want to stuff yourself with that very item and then expect to enjoy it. It's not special. It needs to be a little special. Okay, so, Dan, you had a question? Okay, so here's a big question. I want to spend just 5 minutes on this and I want to jump back into details. It's going to be a lot of little details today, if you like. But why do we make such a big deal about eating matzah and staying away from chametz? And I'm going to repeat it again next week in the beginning of the class on the Seder. So you might hear this a few times. I'll say it on Shabbat. By the way, I'm doing an Ask the Rabbi session on Shabbat because I think it's a great opportunity for people to ask questions about the holiday and anything in general. So this Saturday, if you're around, come and ask me questions. And don't make me stand up there and just stare at everybody. Awkward silence. What is the big deal? I mean, we were not the only people to be enslaved and subsequently emancipated. We were slaves a long time ago. You know, the African community was enslaved here also. They don't have a Seder every year. And it's like, I mean, and ours was thousands of years ago. It's like, move on. Why do we dwell on it so much? And you know, we're supposed to remember the Exodus every day when you say the Shema. And when you bench, when you brakat hamazon, you say grace after meals. It's in there too. And you're supposed to be kind to the stranger, widow, and orphan because you were a slave in Egypt. And it happens again and again and again. And then once a year, we have to relive it around the Seder. I mean, it's just obsessive about the Exodus. So I want to share one very, very brief idea. It's a very theological concept, and it's really what separates the men from the boys. Or the women from the girls, it doesn't sound as good. But it's an idea that really, a lot of people believe in God. It's not such a big deal to believe in God. The real question is...
what God is?
Who God is, and what kind of God you believe in, and whether or not that God is involved in your life.
And yeah, you bring the four Jews together... And so for some people, it's every day that you think about God, that you bracha and these kind of things. And for Pesach, all the Jews are together. And
yeah, but think about the story. That's the way we celebrate it. We bring all Jews together. Why? What is it about the Exodus that teaches us some very important message that we have to constantly
because
be reminded of?
We were not even able to ask questions. Because we were so deep into slavery that we forgot most of
our not to worship false gods.
Okay, we were very much steeped in ancient Egyptian polytheism. It was very hard to tell the Jew from the Egyptian in those days, by the way.
It's the first time Yisrael's name. It's like the birth of the Jewish people.
It is the birth of the Jewish people.
Also, isn't Nisan?
But what is it about God? Stay on God for a minute.
We experience God, even though it wasn't the real ultimate.
And how did we experience God? The first time we experienced God as a nation doing something for us, because we saving us. So what's that? So that is really, Nachmanides speaks to that. The great Kabbalist and Talmudist Nachmanides writes that God is really introducing himself to the world, to people. Now, of course, we know God existed way before the Exodus. Who was he talking to in the Garden of Eden? It was Adam and Eve, Abram, Isaac and Jacob, Noah. It was all individuals. When does God make a splash to humanity? And when does he demonstrate he's not only a God of creation, but also a God of history? That is the Exodus. That is the first time that God responds to the cries of a nation, of a people,
plagues.
And not an individual.
Not the plagues?
That's the plagues.
Oh.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, when I talk about the Exodus, I'm talking about the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah.
All the 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, bringing us out, the Egyptians getting drowned in that sea. That whole drama is a demonstration of God, not only as our creator, but God is our sustainer. And that's what separates the men from the boys a little. Do we believe in, and what kind of God do we believe in? Is it a God that created the world, set it on automatic timer, and took off? Einstein believed in that kind of God. Einstein believed in God. He believed in God who created the universe. But he didn't believe in a personal relationship with God. He believed in a Spinoza type of God. That didn't really have much to do. Even Aristotle, who believed in God, believed in this thing called general providence, where God relates to humanity in a general, but not to, you know, not to Mark, not to, and he's actually listening when we talk to him, and he's responding, and he knows what's going on, he's aware, he cares. A God of benevolence. And this is the reason why we have questions about God. And why when bad things happen to good people, we ask. Because if you don't believe in that kind of God, you don't have any questions. Because the Holocaust can happen. You can be like, whatever. God has nothing to do with my life. God doesn't care. God just created us, willed us into existence, and whatever, let everybody do whatever the heck they want, so the Nazis got the upper hand and we suffered.
But isn't that the
sort of only reason we have questions, we have issues, is because the God to which we subscribe is a benevolent, good, and giving God that cares and that we believe responds to the cries of people. Oh, so how come he responded here and he didn't respond there? Okay, that's not our discussion tonight, but it's a really good question. And it's only a question because that's the kind of God we traditionally believe in. And think about this. Let me just say the whole idea and I'll take your question. That is what matzah and that's what chametz is about. Why do we eat matzah?
Because of the command of Torah.
Thank you. Deeper. What does the Torah say? What's the reason the Torah says to eat matzah?
We left too quickly.
Because we left in such a haste that we didn't keep a chipazon yatzatim mitzrayim, because you left Egypt in such a haste, and you don't, and the ugot and the loaves of bread that they were baking didn't have time to rise. Okay, that's sweet, nice, who cares? What does it matter that we left Egypt in a haste? Or we took our own sweet time. Rav Hirsch, the great German Jewish philosopher, suggested the fact that we left in a rush, and we're eating matzah to symbolize we left in a rush, teaches us that what kind of event was this? Was this a...
unexpected.
Thank you. Perfect. It was an unexpected event. If it was expected, we would have known when we were going, and we probably would not be involved in something as mundane as baking bread. Right? If you were involved in a revolution to overthrow the oppressive Pharaoh regime, you wouldn't be baking bread. You'd be making plans. You'd be staging a coup. And you'd be like planning and getting out, not baking bread. The fact they were baking bread demonstrates that they had no idea. They were like children, you know, just going about their business. And God was like, drop the bread, we're going. Ah! And then they go. And that's basically a demonstration of a God-orchestrated event. Chametz is just the opposite. Chametz are the same ingredients as matzah, just the difference is time. You know that. In order for something to be considered chametz, it has to be worthy of becoming matzah. One of the five types of grains that is manipulated without water before 18 minutes. Chametz is literally just the opposite. It's very interesting. That which we are bidden to eat and that which we are forbidden from eating. Same kind of ingredients. What does chametz represent? Chametz, what's the difference? You see a piece of matzah and a piece of chametz. The matzah is very flat. It's modest. And the chametz is bloated. There's a beautiful prayer that some Hasidim say when they go searching. When do we search for the chametz, guys?
14th.
The 14th at night, which is next Thursday night. Give yourself a little time next Thursday night to search your home for chametz. We'll talk about it in a few moments. When you're searching for your chametz, some of the Hasidim, before they make the blessing, they say that I'm about to embark upon a search for chametz. I'm not just looking out there in my home for chametz. I'm looking here. Where's the chametz? The chametz is the arrogance. It's the haughtiness to believe that man orchestrates everything. And there might be a God, but he has nothing to do with things. And I can basically clean God out of the equation, and it's all people. It's all me. It's what I do that matters. It's the degrees that I've accumulated, the hard work I put in. Nothing else really is a force in this world. Now, we don't go to the other extreme and say, well, all we do is believe in God. Sorry, we don't have to go to school. We don't have to work hard. We just pray, pray, pray. And hopefully God will turn out everything perfectly. We don't believe in that either. We have this thing called hishtadlut, human initiative. And that relationship between chazdei Hashem, God's kindness, and hishtadlut, and what you and I do, that is incredibly important in life. Now, don't tell me where one starts and the other one ends. For that, I'd have to be much more than a rabbi. That's like prophecy. That's like prophet-level stuff. Like, you know, do I have to go out again? If I go out again, I'll meet my bishop. No. If I put I put the left foot first, I put the right, the boss will hire me, he won't hire me. Does it really come down to that? Hashem's blessing, where does my efforts begin? And God's, I don't know. I really don't know. It's very hard. The 9:30 class I teach after this, we delve into these things. The Ramchal, the great Rabbeinu Moshe Chaim Lutzato, wrote a few books on Hashgacha. You ever go to a restaurant, you need a good mashgiach, not mashiach, mashgiach, a supervisor. God is hashgacha, God is supervising the world. We don't quite exactly know it all, but we're given some basics, and a big basic is Passover. Because Passover represents our belief not only a God of creation, but a God of history. And that's why we eat matzah, flat, modest, believing in something greater, try to stay away from the bloat of the chametz, the ego that allows us to entertain the false notions that it's only us that's moving and guiding things in this world. It's a lofty idea. Just wanted to share that. It's something to think about. You could use it at your Seder table also if you'd like.
Time, like they were supposed to leave later and they moved the time they're supposed to leave. I forgot the significance.
Well, I mean, the fact that I don't necessarily think that it was like changed or anything like that.
Weren't
they supposed to leave in the morning or something, and then go up next to the night?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I heard that too.
Well, I do know it says they were supposed to leave at any point because God is operating also with people. At any point that Pharaoh would say go, we were going to leave. The only reason it took so long, these plagues lasted for months. Until Pharaoh and the Egyptians were basically brought to their knees and they were like, fine, just go already. He could have done that a lot earlier. I don't know if that's what you're referring to. Sounds like something else.
Maybe it's because the Jews were chased out. Like they didn't, like Pharaoh said leave, but it was like, you need to take your time. Like they were kind of chased out. Like,
we were now. There's a whole Kabbalistic spiritual explanation for that. And I thought you were touching on that. Does anybody know? What does that mean? They had to leave at that precise moment. They couldn't stay a second longer. Because according to the Kabbalists, we were on the Memtet Shari Tumah, the 49th level of ritual impurity, 50 is rock bottom. There would have been no saving us. We were so close to being Egyptian, spiritually, that we had to be taken out of that very precise moment, and had we allowed to stay longer, there wouldn't have been anything left to save. By the way, how many Jews actually left?
Yeah, but didn't the Jews that marked their doorposts, like they're the ones that left, but correct, didn't mark their doorposts?
Showed that they were dedicated to. Anybody know what Olga is referring to? What's the marking the doorpost?
That, yes.
What's that? What, the last plague? What was the last plague?
Death of the firstborn.
Right? So, what God couldn't figure out which were the Jewish homes, which weren't the Jewish homes? You look for the cholent, wherever the cholent is, you don't kill those. Hashem couldn't figure it out. Why did every Jew have to take the lamb? Slaughter the Egyptian lamb.
Because
what's that?
It was an Egyptian.
Because it was an Egyptian deity. Yeah. To take its blood and put it on the thing was their way of showing I'm with this God and not that God.
There okay. Some that didn't do it.
Well, right. So what percentage of Jews actually left?
600,000 kids and 600,000.
No, there were 600,000 altogether, men between 20 and 60, we know, because there was a census taken in the Torah. So there were about 2 to 3 million, but guess how many didn't go? By the way, this is a consistent sociological statistic in Jewish history, this number of Jews who actually make it out and survive and actually stay Jewish in almost every generation. It's always the same. And it's going to depress the heck out of you.
So 600,000 left and
600,000 men between 20 and 60. So kids, women, older people.
10%.
20%. It says in the Torah, Chamushim aluma Mitzrayim, and the Jewish people left Chamushim. What does the word Chamushim mean? So Rashi brings down two interpretations. Chamushim means Mizuyanim, armed. They took the Egyptians' warfare. They knew they'd have to defend themselves in the wilderness. And from the word Chamesh.
A fifth.
One fifth. Four-fifths of the Jewish community were not worthy of redemption. They never made it out. Now, it sounds a little harsh, but actually, if you look at Jewish history, almost consistently, that's what happened. That's what's happening here in the United States, too. It's always about one-fifth. Not just physically annihilated, assimilated, but in the end of the day, it's the same thing.
Wait,
yeah.
Was it because they weren't spiritually allowed to because they got the 50th level, or was there...
They weren't with the game. They weren't with the game. We lost a lot of, you know, what percentage of our brothers and sisters in Russia did we lose? It's not like, you know, anyone woke up and made a choice, I'm not going to be Jewish anymore today, but over a couple of generations, we lost them. I just got this email from my sister-in-law, and she wasn't going to share this, but you brought it up. And it's called, did you see this? The following is a new interpretation of the four sons. We're not judging here, just witnessing. Besides, what better time to talk about choices and change than Passover? The first son, let's call him Irving. He came to America in the early 1900s, not only because his family had a terrible, poor existence in Poland, but mostly because they were running for their lives to escape the pogroms. Irving and thousands like him came to America, came with nothing, but America gave them safety. As a boy, he spoke Yiddish and went to yeshiva. When he arrived in America, he learned English. His family remained observant, continuing to follow kosher rules, celebrating Shabbat every week, and living a traditional Jewish life. Irving's commitment to Judaism was unshakable. Who's the next son? And the four sons in the Haggadah. We'll talk about this next week. Okay, we're not going to call him the wicked son, but that's what the Haggadah calls him. Irving's son, David, is the second generation. David grew up in America with a strong Jewish identity. He's comfortable in his mom and dad's home, which is filled with Jewish traditions and his values. But let's just say he and his family became more American. He never experienced any anti-Semitism, but felt like he had to run, for his life. His goal was to become a successful business executive, and he did. Became so successful, he was one of the first Jews to be accepted into his local country club that would never allow Jews before. David took his family to Paris and Rome, but forgot to take them to Israel. He did a great job of assimilating, but sort of a lackluster job of teaching his son Josh, who you'll meet below, about Judaism. The third,
Josh had a hell of a bar mitzvah, though.
The third, the simple son, is the third. Meet David's son Josh. He's third generation Jews in America. Josh is like, well, lots of us. He considers himself culturally Jewish. He may have had a Seder at his grandfather Irving's house, but Josh, by way, is an excellent soccer player, never really concentrated on his Judaism. He felt very little anti-Semitism growing up. He quit Hebrew school because it conflicted with soccer practice, and he went to Hillel a couple of times at Duke. But it felt too Jewish for him. Josh did go on a Josh did go on a birthright trip, but that was a few years ago. David is bummed that Josh doesn't have a stronger connection to Judaism. But what are you going to do? By the way, Josh is married Josh is married to Shannon, who is Protestant, but would like to learn about Judaism. Unfortunately, Josh doesn't feel like he knows her enough to teach her. The fourth son, who's the fourth?
Luke.
You saw it.
Guys, made it
up. Dude, that was awesome.
I got it.
finally meet Josh and Shannon's son, Luke.
Why Luke?
You'll hear in a minute, dude. Of course, he knows his dad is Jewish and actually loves seeing old photographs of Irving. But other than that, he has little connection to Judaism. We really miss and need all Lukes. Let's work together to invite everyone who's disengaged from their Judaism back to our sometimes dysfunctional, often confusing, but always loving community.
Wait, was Duke University really in there?
Yeah, I read it.
Wait, seriously? I went to
my sister-in-law just... Yeah, but
that's pretty
good. Girlfriend is not Shannon.
Yeah, sure.
Did you get a Shannon?
Okay, anyway.
Can I ask my question now?
Yeah, I also.
Yes, you had a question. Wait, but why are we talking about this?
I don't know.
We talked about 1/5. We lose 4/5. By the way, so that's how we lose 4/5. Yeah, go for it.
Thank you. So in Judaism, we have this idea of multiple New Years. So there's a physical New Year's Rosh Hashanah.
Right.
Like the New Year for the trees.
Right.
And then Pesach is the
spiritual. The New Year for the people.
But I thought it was like a spiritual New Year. But how is that like different from physical? Like, that's what I don't know.
Because Rosh Hashanah celebrates the creation of the world, actually. Passover celebrates the purpose of the world, which is redemption. And that's one of the reasons why some would actually consider this even more important, but they're like, sort of like bookends. You got to start physically, but why are you here physically? And that is because we want to bring ourselves in individually and bring the world to a higher level of existence, what's called redemption. Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, God. I've 20 minutes to do all this. Yeah.
Maria Kaplan has a great article on
it. How did you know that we were Jewish? We didn't declare the nation of Israel as Jewish people until after after the Exodus. How did you know if you were Jewish to do that?
To do what?
Like when you had to mark your door. If we lost 20% of our people obviously self-identified as something, but it wasn't quite...
Most of those Jews, according to the rabbis, were no longer in existence. Most of the Jews that perished along with the Egyptians, perished in the plague of darkness, which preceded the slaying of the firstborn, which is when that blood ritual was performed. Rashi also brings down the Talmudic tradition that 4/5 of the Jewish community basically fell off with the Egyptians. They were indistinguishable, and as not to embarrass them, they perished during the 3-day period of unexplained darkness, which was the Makkah of Choshech, a plague of dark. Whoever was left basically.
So, but there were still Egyptians left, right?
Tons.
So then, how did you? They
were the oppressors and the slaves.
Okay.
Yeah, you could tell there was a caste system in ancient Egypt, and the Jews were the Israelites were not the only people that were enslaved by the ancient pharaohs. We were just the only one who escaped, we think.
Did the Jewish people put themselves at risk by kind of self-identifying?
100%. 100%. They had to choose. They had to choose what was less dangerous and what did they really believe in. Because basically you're taking your oppressor's God and publicly slaying him.
So it's
just like suicide.
Yeah.
But at that point, God had made enough of a case for himself.
Right. Burning a Christmas tree?
All right, let's open up your packet, please. I have 20 minutes to go through this packet with you. This is really important.
Okay. The best of the worst.
Now, we want to get rid of all of our chametz. Okay? And
I don't have one.
Oh, you don't have one. Okay. So, by the way, next Thursday, let's just do this first. Next Thursday night, skip, please, to page 14. Skip to page 14. The time for Bedikat Chametz next Thursday night is 8 o'clock. If anyone's not going to be home next Thursday night, let's say you're going away for the holiday, you just do the Bedikah, which is the search in your home, the night before you leave, whatever that is. The only time you can do the blessing, though, is Thursday night on the 14th. When the time for the Bedikah arrives, one should immediately defer any other activities and begin the search. It's a real search. You're actually looking for chametz in your home. And what you can do is, you really should try to clean before this, but you could cram it all into this if you needed to, if you were too busy. It's better to just use this as a stopgap just in case you forgot to find anything. And you light a candle. You don't have to light a candle. You can use a flashlight. And you make the blessing. Take a look at the blessing there. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam. It's in the italics. Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvotav Tzivanu Al Bi'ur Chametz. You also have it here on this other packet. You guys with me here? It's also here on this packet on the last page. And blessed are you, God, King of the Universe, who sanctified us with His commandments and has commanded us concerning the removal of chametz. And then what do? You look around. You just look around your home for chametz. What if you don't find any? There's a custom to take a few pieces of bread and put them around. Do me a favor, remember where you put the bread. I don't want to get a phone call. I can't find the last piece of bread. That's happened before. Just remember where you put them. Look for them. Let me say the whole thing and then I'll take your question. Gather up the 10 pieces and whatever chametz you might find. And then you're going to do what's called a bittul.
What?
A bittul. Bittul. It's a Hebrew word. Bitul, it means it's a nullification. It's a verbal nullification.
Okay.
Where you're going to take a look, and you should do it in English. Take a look what it says.
Hey.
Okay. I've been, one second. Bitul, I just did this with Jesse before, so he's an expert at this. Look at the last paragraph from 14. At the conclusion of the search, you guys with me? Uh-huh. Back on the big packet. At the conclusion of the search, all chametz is placed in a known location and declaration bittul is made, annulling all chametz, which remains hidden. Because this declaration is a legal one, it's valid only if you actually understand what you're saying. So unless you're fluent in Aramaic, you should try to say the bittul in English. What's the bittul? You have it there on page 15. Any chametz that's in the box, or leaven that's in my possession, which I've not seen, I've not removed, shall be annulled and ownerless like the dust of the earth. Okay? By the way, what that does is if I take my phone and I say, I am declaring this phone ownerless like the dust of the earth, I put it down, you pick it up. It's not theft anymore. It's your phone. You can verbally annul ownership of anything. And this is very important because let's say you live with a roommate who happens not to be Jewish, or let's say they are Jewish but they're not observant and they're going to keep their chametz around. As long as you verbally annul any of the chametz, you get rid of your chametz, or you sell it, and you do this, you're good, even if you actually can see other people's chametz. You might go to work and see other people's chametz. It happens. I don't think the whole world removes himself of chametz. And that's why I always encourage people to sell your chametz. You don't have to sell your chametz, but if you want to hold on to your chametz, and you don't have to throw it out, take it, put it in a cupboard somewhere in your home. You could even leave the refrigerated chametz stuff in your refrigerator. Just put it behind some stuff, put a piece of paper on it so you don't inadvertently take it out and use it on the holiday. And then you'll fill out a form. Take a look right over here, guys. Boom. The form on the back here. Fill it out. Give it to me after class tonight. I'm going to ask you to lift my phone or something in the air. It's one of the ways that we engage in a legal acquisition. You're going to transfer the. You're going to give me power of attorney, basically, and I'm going to give your chametz form to a rabbi.
Your phone?
My phone or your phone doesn't matter. As long as you lift something.
Is it a possession?
Maybe yours, because I see you're eyeing it. We'll use your phone.
You put the phone idea in his head.
Right? Yeah. And basically, I'm going to hand your sheet that you filled out to another rabbi who's actually going to sell your chametz. Theoretically, somebody could walk into your home, and you know, some rabbis used to ask for keys. They don't do this anymore. But somebody else owns that food. So if you eat your chametz on Passover, you're not only in violation of eating chametz on Passover, but you're also stealing from someone else because you don't own it. It gets transferred back to you. What's that?
It's some guy.
It's usually a custodian of a synagogue. I've been there when they've done this. But I give it to Shuki. Shuki gives it to Rabbi Zirkin. Rabbi Zirkin brings it to Riverdale, to Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig sells it, probably about a dozen or 15 synagogues worth of chametz. He's a very wealthy man. He doesn't have to pay a lot for it either, but it's a real sale. It's actually a real sale. And then it kicks back in after the holiday is over. You should wait like an hour or so when the holiday is over, just so you can know that it's kicking back, you know. And that's how you're selling. You don't have to do this if you want to get rid of all your chametz. Gazenta hate, as they say in French. You can do whatever you want, but this is a way of saving a few dollars. You have some good whiskey and stuff like that. You had a question before.
Yeah, so it's related to. So this one, you have to say it in English if you don't know Aramaic. But in general, any other prayers, can you say them in English?
100%.
Okay.
100%. Good question.
The bitul, two questions. Do you have to have a witness?
No.
You make a verbal?
No.
So you don't?
No.
And also, if I've committed the bitul, why do I also need to sell it for double protection?
And you can ask another question. Why do I have to sell it if I did a bitul?
Yeah.
And why do I have to do a search? If I just declared everything ownerless, even if I miss, if I overlook something, so the Talmud discusses all this in the Tractate of Psachim, and it says because even if you did a bittul, so you don't own it, you still might eat that devil dog because you're used to eating the devil dog. The reason we, I hope it's okay, I use devil dog as an example. It's just my favorite chametz looking thing, but I use it. Passover is interesting because non kosher food. If you're keeping kosher, you're not eating non kosher food all year. You get used to staying away from shrimp. Lobster, I don't know. But Passover, all of a sudden, food you're eating all year becomes taboo for 8 days. So the rabbis lop on all of these added restrictions. That's why people go a little crazy preparing for Passover, because your ability to mess up is greater. Because you're being asked not to eat something that's okay the rest of the year. So that's why we go through all these steps. We search for, we actually destroy, I'm going to get to that in a minute. We search for it, we sell it. We do a verbal nullification. Last thing, Thursday night, you're searching around, you gather up those 10 little pieces of bread, whatever chametz you might found, you put in a little pekala, you make your declaration. What do you do the next morning? You burn it. Now, where did this come from? It's actually a verse in the Torah. It doesn't say burn, it says tashbitu. There's a biblical injunction to destroy the chametz, which gets back into the philosophy that I mentioned earlier, that we're trying to rid ourselves of that which represents the ego and the arrogance. Get rid of it. There's a debate. Can you just flush it down the toilet? Do you actually have to burn it? There's a debate between Talmudic sages, and we follow the opinion of burning. So I don't know if you make fires in your home. Don't do that. Come to the Jewish Center on Friday morning. What time does it say here? And there will be in the back alley, there will be a garbage pail where you can burn your chametz. Has anyone done this? Has anyone burnt their chametz before?
No.
It's an amazing thing. It's a big mitzvah to do. You are fulfilling a biblical command by bringing your chametz, a little piece of bread, and throwing it in that bin and burning it, destroying it. Just remember, it's nice to think about ideas, but the way ideas come alive is when you ritualize them, when you actually physically do something. So take a look. It says it right here. It'll be chametz may be eaten Take a look on page.
Where is the burning?
I'm going to tell you right now.
Burning between 10 and 115.
Look at page 16. Burning the chametz. Chametz may be eaten until 10:16 on Friday. Chametz must be burned and nullified on Friday morning, the latest by 11:36. So you come, I think if you come any time between like probably 9 o'clock, 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and 11:30, you can just come and burn it, or you can burn it yourself. Just don't do it in your apartment. I don't want to get any calls from anyone. Says here you may bring your chametz to the Jewish Center on Monday morning. God bless you. Not Monday morning is wrong, by the way. Friday morning, April 19th, to be burnt between 10 and 11:15. 10 and 11:15. I do this in the hotel. I'm a rabbi in one of these crazy Florida hotels. We burn the chametz. It's a whole big to-do. It's great. Any questions about this kind of stuff? I know it might sound a little strange. Yeah. You didn't have a question. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't have a question about the technical stuff. Chametz. Do you think chametz represents the ego?
In some, according to some, yeah. We could talk about it a little more. I dwelt on it a little earlier on.
What do you do about curio? What do you do?
About what?
Curio.
What's curio?
Kineo.
Kidney oats. I try not to eat them because I'm Ashkenaz.
Uh-huh.
Svardim don't refrain from eating kidney oat. Kidney oat refers to certain food items that are not chametz, but could be confused with chametz. And the... What's that?
Rice or something?
Yeah, rice, millet, corn.
Quinoa.
There is kosher for Passover quinoa.
Yeah.
If you want to get yourself a great book, there's so much kosher. You have no idea how easier it is to keep Passover, especially in New York today. There's so much that's kosher for Passover.
Lots of buns. I've seen.
I mean, at the hotel, what am I eating here? It looks like. And my dad, even my dad's generation, not so long ago, would be like, we just ate potatoes for 8 days. Everything was potatoes,
isn't that
potatoes,
like
potatoes.
Do you eat those things?
No, it's fine. As long as there's no chametz in
like,
it.
It feels like a loophole just to like...
It feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not. If it's okay, it's okay. I mean, I'm saying we technology has allowed us to eat things that look like they're chametz, but in fact, they're not. Now, if you want to be like a super holy dude, then don't do it.
Yeah.
I'm not stopping you.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about your kitchens a little, because we haven't spent any time speaking about your kitchens. So, by the way, make it really simple. Make it really simple. Listen, I'm not telling... Everyone's got to figure out what they want to do, what level of religious observance you're at, what this Passover is going to look like. I'll give you one little suggestion. Do something more than you did last year. Whatever it is, make sure you're moving forward. And if you want to take on much more, great. And I'm around to discuss this over the next week. You can call me, we can schmooze it out. Take home this packet. Don't get overwhelmed. Don't be like, oh, I'm a terrible Jew, I'm not doing all of these things. But there's a lot of good stuff in here. There's a lot of kosher for Passover stuff there, out there. And technically, you want to know what to do when it comes to fruits, vegetables, and poultry and meat. Obviously doesn't need to be kosher for Passover. It just needs to be, poultry and meat need to come from a kosher place. And your fruits and vegetables are fruits and vegetables, and dairy and milk also. But almost everything else needs a kosher for Passover label. The only thing that technically doesn't is probably coffee and tea. But decaffeinated coffee and decaffeinated tea need a kosher for Passover label, because the decaffeination process contains certain enzymes that have either kidney out or chametz itself.
Oh.
Beer's got chametz in it. Like, there's so much stuff that almost everything has chametz. Wine. Just letting you know.
Wine
also kosher for Passover, because the way it's the wine itself, there's nothing in there. That's the plants. What do you call it? The way it's made on the machines. They have to be kosher because it gets hot, and then it transfers the taste of the non-kosher for Passover food. So that's why we have kosher for Passover. Great wines, by the way. There's an explosion of excellent wines from Israel, from all over the world, that are kosher today. You don't have to kill yourself at the Seder with that heavy Malaga syrupy stuff that destroyed me after like a half a cup, when I was a kid. They have really... Get yourself, I'm telling you, if you can... some really good kosher wine for the Seder, because it'll help. All right. Now, why do we have anything going on in our kitchen? As long as I buy kosher for Passover food, and by the way, that's a really good place to start. You don't want to do anything with your kitchen. This is too much. The rabbi's getting a little too personal here. Stay out of the kitchen. You know, I'll buy kosher for Passover food. That's a big deal. It is. And I'm not trying to take that away. That's step one. You want to go a little deeper, start talking about your dishes. You want to keep it simple? Paper. paper. Just make everything simple. So if you would like to, so there's two options. You can kosher most of the things in your kitchen. The only thing you can't really kosher for Passover is earthenware and glass. We don't kosher. Earthenware is, nobody calls it earthenware. I'm speaking like a Talmudic passage. Klicheres. Like a plate, a dish, a mug, a... Now, if you used it...
Ceramic?
Actually, according to some, you can do glass.
Glass.
Yeah, because glass is not absorbent, according. But we're strict on Passover. We rule a little stricter on things. So, like for example, I'll kosher hard plastic during the year, but not for Passover. Like you have something that's made out of hard plastic and it's not kosher, and you want to make it kosher. There's a way of koshering it. You just dip it in a hot boiling vat of water, clean it, dip it, and you're good. But the OU, for example, won't kosher hard plastic for Passover, which makes it hard to kosher your dishwasher. It's doable, but you have to change the racks, and it's a whole pain in Megillah, you know. So most people just don't use their dishwashers for that week, you know. If you have more, you could. If it was all metal inside, you could totally kosher your dishwasher.
How do you kosher, like...
Oh, a pan or a pot? So it all depends on... The Talmud says, kabolo kachpoto, the way something absorbed non-kosher, or in this case, non-kosher for Passover, is the same way it's expunged. It's a biochemical reality. This is not like Kabbalah, mysticism. If you ever apply heat to something, heat has the ability to transfer the taste of something into something else. The only way to remove it is to apply the same medium. The only exceptions are things that are so absorbent that no matter how much heat you apply, it can't come out, like wood or earthenware. And that's why there's just nothing you can do. But if you have a mug, for example, and you never use the mug for anything other than cold, then you just clean it out. The only thing you have to really kosher are things that we use with hot, with heat, like a pot or a pan. So I can. It's very simple. If you want to kosher a pot or a pan, you clean it well, leave it for 24 hours, and then dunk it into a hot vat of boiling water. Just take another... Quickly, just dump it in, that's it. Doesn't have to be there for very long. Same with utensils. Metal, anything that's metal, that's the way you would kosher it. The only thing is if... what were you asking, Olga?
No, I'm just saying, like, sometimes when pots and pans are big, like, don't you have to use, like, a stone that's...
Ah, so if the pot is so big that you don't have another pot to put that pot into, so you can kosher that by simply cleaning it out, leaving it for 24 hours, and then taking water, boiling it in that pot. The reason you got the stone thing is because you need a way of taking the hot boiling water and letting it go over the lip. How do you do that? So you take a rock, put it on your stove, use tongs, take the rock, after the water has boiled in the pot, take the rock, which is really hot, and just put it in there and it'll sizzle and it'll drip over the side and then you've koshered the pot, actually. That's the way you kosher something which is too big to be koshered in something else.
One more question.
By the way, you don't have to do this. By the way, mikvah is a separate thing. Mikvah is only if the item is new or it has never been toveled before. It has nothing to do with kashrut or Passover, really. But if you're buying something new, some people just buy new stuff. They want to just cook on Passover, go out and buy a new pot, you don't have to kashrut it. Then you would have to go to the mikvah, just take the pot and immerse it in the mikvah. Correct.
But the only thing with like washing a pot or whatever is sometimes it's hard to get stuff off.
Okay, so you have to. You can take a picture of it and send it to me. If it's something which is so embedded in it, that's fine. If it's a burn, it doesn't matter. It's not food anymore. Once something is not classified as food anymore, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, medicine. Does medicine have to be covered? Because that might not be considered food either.
I saw in Borough Park kosher for Passover lipstick.
Right.
Why?
So there's a debate. There's a debate as to whether or not items that are not... Hang on. It's a very good question. There's a debate as to whether or not items that are not really seen as food, but you still consume them, whether or not they still have the status of chametz. So I can tell you, I'm going to give you a more of a lenient opinion, but I think it's very reliable. Anything that's not food is not subject to these rules and laws, and you don't have to start looking for a kosher for Passover lipstick or shampoo or soap or anything like that, even if it gets into the thing, which gets into the thing, it's not considered food. The only difference is same thing. I don't think you need to, but some people, I told you, some people are very, very strict, and they would say, well, it's going to be rubbed into your dishes, and it could be absorbed, but I don't think it needs to be kosher for Passover. I'm trying to give you guys a little more of a lenient kind of approach, because this is very heavy stuff. So I'll tell you this famous story. So happy I'm not teaching this next week when the Kavanah teacher. That's all I know. Like, you're not getting this award. You're brainwashing your people.
Simone, why don't you take the night off next week?
You send me like a ticket to a good show. These two tickets showed up in my doorstep to a really good show.
We'll just pick the best for the best of Jesse.
Wait, hold on. Someone asked about what was the other thing? So this is a great story. You got to hear this. You got to love this. You know the famous story about toothpaste? So the Talmud says, how do you know?
The one about the toothpaste.
How do you know if something is considered food and therefore subject to these rules or not? So the Talmud says, ra'ui la'achilat kelev. Anything that is worthy of being eaten by a dog.
Oh, brother.
This is what the Talmud says. If a dog would eat it, then it's food, and then it's subject to the rules and laws of the Talmud. If a dog wouldn't eat it, then it's not considered food, and you don't have to worry about it.
If someone...
you know where this is going. So somebody once came to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he said to him, Rabbi, this is a true story. He came to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he said, last night, you know, I fed toothpaste to my dog. I put it on the thing, and my dog ate it. So now that means, I guess, that my toothpaste has to be kosher for Passover. Does it? And he asked him, and Rabbi, I'm telling the Rabbi Soloveitchik toothpaste joke. He doesn't know the toothpaste joke. Look at this. It's Elijah the prophet that is coming. Look at this.
Model fabling now. I'm giving you seven now.
Okay. I'm done at four. Okay, you're the man. I'm fine. I hurt my back today. So, what's the...
The toothpaste joke.
So he said, it's not a joke, it was a real case, that's why it's so funny. Which was that, he said, your toothpaste does not have to be kosher for Passover. And you're an idiot for giving your dog toothpaste. So, because these are categories, you understand the fact that you have a fakakta dog that likes to eat toothpaste doesn't now mean that toothpaste has to be kosher for Passover. Just means that your dog eats anything. But that doesn't mean that's something you would classically feed to a dog. So therefore, I don't think toothpaste has to be kosher for Passover. You will find kosher for Passover toothpaste and people that are careful to do that. That's fine, but I'm answering your question. You don't need to do it, okay? And I'm trying to give lenient answers so that people will be encouraged to observe.
What about medication?
So I don't think... Also, there's a debate. We discussed this. According to some... First of all, life-threatening medication, you take. That's not a question. Non-life-threatening medication is a debate. Some say it's not considered food, therefore it's fine. Others say that if you can try to find a kosher for Passover version, it's better. Vitamins is a little different. And vitamins, I really think, need to be kosher for Passover because they're not really seen as medicine necessarily. If they're chewable, especially if they make them with a little flavor in it, now you're getting into the category of food. And if it's food...
Please don't give that extra.
All right, let me finish up. Okay, any other questions about your kitchen? If you want a kosher, by the way, you can just keep it simple, clean.
So what are you koshering for? To get rid of anything that's touched chametz?
You're only koshering things that you're going to use. If you're not going to use something for the duration of the holiday, just put it away. You don't have to disinfect your home and go crazy and start cleaning your toilet and the flusher and the faucet. That is not, it's in your bathroom. You want to have a clean bathroom? Great. Don't blame it on Passover. Okay? Nobody go crazy. Okay? Just I'm talking about your kitchen. Your kitchen needs to be kosher for Passover if you want to cook in it, the items you're going to use. But if you know you're not going to use a whole bunch of items, just put them aside and you don't have to touch them. You don't have to do anything.
You want one frying pan.
Right. So one frying pan. Do you want to buy a new one or you want to kosher the old one? So kosher the old one. Find a pot that's bigger and fill it up, boil it, and then take and clean your pot, keep it for 24 hours, and then immerse it in there. And you don't have to immerse it at one point. You can immerse it, use gloves. You can immerse half of it, and then turn it around and immerse the other half.
I actually like, what do you do with your electrical blech?
Some people just double wrap it with tin foil. You can use the same blech, clean it, and double wrap it. Put two things of tin foil.
I don't. I was imagining an even larger vat of somewhere. And you're having a. I was excited to see. It's a big metal plate. Who doesn't need?
Here, kosher powder and liquid detergents do not require a kosher for Passover label. Medicines. If medicine is required for life, sustaining therapy may be used. If not for life, some authorities permit while others prohibit. If available, capsules are preferable. Before discontinuing any medication, please consult your doctor. It's best to discuss with a rabbi on these matters as well. Any other questions? Anyone here a firstborn male?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, do I have to get redeemed?
Fast.
Oh.
You don't have to fast if you attend what's called a seal. You would only be fasting on. Anybody know why does a firstborn male fast?
Because I didn't get killed.
Right. Good. So you can get out of the fast. It's only a half a day fast. It's from Friday morning until the Seder.
Uh-huh.
You can get out of the fast by
putting blood on the lintel of your.
No, stop.
That's really good.
I guess. You don't have to fast if you attend.
I don't know.
A seal.
A seum
in the Jewish center.
What is a
seum? A seum is a celebration of the completion of a tractate of the Talmud. Coincidentally, we happen to have people that are completing a tractate of the Talmud on the very morning when you have to fast. If you get invited to one of those parties, there's a mitzvah to eat something, and therefore you don't have to fast. That's what everyone does. Almost no one fasts.
Really?
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Yes, okay. We'll do that. Wait, before we're done here. Any other questions?
We'll
talk about the Seder next week.
Great.
Any other questions?
Don't the firstborn also have to be redeemed at some point, too, with like a shekel or whatever?
That's when you're born.
Oh.
It's too late.
I was going to say, I don't think I've been redeemed.
All right, guys. We got to do this. Come over here. Let's do this together. It's been over there.